From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in an operating room when a third-year medical student named Ron Epstein was assisting a senior urologist. This was Ron's first clinical rotation in surgery, and he naturally felt some hesitation about his role, how he fit into the team in the room. The doctor was performing a lymph node dissection, removing the lymph node surrounding both kidneys and the aorta. And then something went awry, and it was Ron, the medical student, who first noticed. He could see one of the kidneys starting to turn blue, but the doctor hadn't seemed to realize it yet. Ron wondered if he should speak up and how forcefully. Well, what happened next was a spark that helped lead Ron Epstein down a path that is not all that routine in modern medicine. Today, Dr. Ronald Epstein is a practicing family physician, and he directs the Center for Communication and Disparities Research at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He's also become an internationally recognized educator on the subject of mindful practice. But what exactly is mindfulness in medicine? Well, let's start with this. Have you ever felt like your doctor wasn't really listening to you or had made up his mind on a diagnosis instead of being open to all possibilities? Or have you felt rushed or anxious with your doctor because you didn't feel like you'd had any real time? They probably were not practicing mindfulness. And Dr. Epstein's new book is called Attending: Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. He's my guest for the hour, and I thought the book was... I connected with so many different things in this book, and I'm just excited to talk to you. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. It really means a lot to me.
And I know you've told the story a lot, but I have to start you where I began the intro here. I want you to tell for our listeners, because this will be new to them, these contrasting stories of experiences you had with one doctor, the senior urologist who I was describing, and then a very different experience you had. Tell me about those.
Well, you started out the story, and I was it was my first rotation during my third year of medical school, so I was pretty green. And the way the operation was conducted then was the surgeon would dissect around one kidney and then switch sides of the table so he could then work on the other kidney. I was across the table from him, so I had a good view of the kidney that he had just dissected, and it began to turn blue. And as a medical student, I didn't really know a lot, but I did know that blue was not good. And so I mentioned it to him, and he basically kind of ignored what I had said, just kind of brushed it off. And I was really hesitant because I knew the unspoken rules about medical students in the operating room. You generally didn't speak up. You just kind of, unless spoken to. Well, a few minutes later, I noticed the kidney starting to turn a dusky purple. And I knew this was bad. And so I mentioned it to the scrub nurse next to me, who mentioned it to the intern who was across the table, who then mentioned it to the surgeon. And the surgeon panicked. And he noticed that it was purple, even though it was always within his field of vision. He just took note and then realized that something was wrong, tried to untwist the kidney, thinking that the blood supply had gotten blocked. That didn't work. And so had to call in a vascular surgeon to do a repair. But kidneys getting twisted, that's fine. I mean, we know that happens. That could be an unanticipated complication. But the fact that he didn't see it and didn't acknowledge it. The stunning thing was the next morning I was on rounds with him, and he explained to the patient, an 18-year-old boy and his mother, that an unavoidable complication had happened in the operating room. And that really stuck with me, because the kidney getting twisted might have been avoidable, but his inattention was not unavoidable. Contrast that with another surgeon who was doing an equally delicate operation. He was repairing a blocked aorta, putting in a graft. And, he was quite chatty, had music going on. And then all of a sudden, as, he was kind of finished sewing it up and they were beginning to release the clamp, he became quiet. And then suddenly went to task working on the repair site again, before anyone else had realized that something was not quite right. In fact, there was a small leak. He fixed it. But what struck me was that even in the midst of working very quickly and with a lot of activity in the operating room, he was attentive to the possibility of failure. He was attentive to the possibility that things might not go as they always had in the past, that there might be something unexpected, something new. And that experience got me looking at doctors from that point forward, who really noticed what was going on, who was curious, who was really present, and who was kind of on autopilot or making assumptions about situations that weren't quite true. And eventually that just got me to thinking about, well, what makes high quality care? It's not just how well you do it on the exam and what your technical skills are, but it's also how well you know your own mind.
Yeah, I think certainly I didn't feel like you thought the senior radiologist in the first anecdote was a bad doctor, just a common situation where a doctor kind of goes down the list, gets locked in, as opposed to being really mindful, really aware, really self-aware, open to thinking bottom up as opposed to top down, which we'll talk about. And so the question becomes, how do you go from that sort of ordinary level of care to something extraordinary? So define for me how you define mindfulness.
Well, mindfulness is the ability to pay attention to what's going on inside you as well as outside you in a non-judgmental way. And that's really important. It means that you observe first, you're aware of your observations, and you don't set any of those observations aside. You approach difficulties with curiosity. You try to be present, even in high-stress situations when you feel like you want to run away and withdraw. So those are qualities, and it also is directed for a purpose. It's directed to practice with clarity and with compassion.
Okay, and you've been writing about this subject for a number of years. In fact, the book is out now, but you wrote in 1999, you wrote something that touched a nerve with colleagues in a lot of different medical quarters, didn't it?
Yeah, I wrote an article called Mindful Practice in JAMA. And for me, it was a personal manifesto. It was a way of trying to put on paper what I aspired to as a clinician, that kind of clarity of mind, clarity of purpose, intentionality, and attitudes towards practice.
And what was the reaction you got?
Well, these were the days when people still wrote letters. So it was rather recent. So I got hundreds of letters and emails and invitations to speak, but it really touched a nerve. And I thought, I would get reactions from maybe family doctors and psychiatrists. But in fact, a lot of the responses were from surgeons and radiologists and subspecialists. It was really completely across the gamut of physician specialties. Of people saying, yes, this is what's really important about my practice, and these are the kinds of doctors I would refer a patient to.
The book is a svelte 200 pages or so. It's called Attending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. I think it will make me a better patient. I mean, I know that this is the kind of book where people are sharing it with their doctors, but I think it will make me a better patient. And we're going to talk a little bit about why that is as we go throughout the hour. Listeners, if you've got questions for Dr. Epstein, especially about your own experience with doctors in various settings, good and bad, positive, negative, or what you would like to see change, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I think it's fair to ask you this, though, right off the top. Yes, we often feel, the general public, often feels like we get squeezed into a short amount of time with an actual doctor. When the actual doctor walks into the room, you better be ready. You better have your questions ready because you don't have a lot of time. They have other patients to see. You feel rushed to some degree. You feel some anxiety that comes from that. You don't want to waste their time, but you've got questions. And do I ask this? Do I not? I'm guessing that some doctors who might be listening, Dr. Epstein, would say, what you're describing with mindfulness would be great if we didn't have the complicated healthcare system we do that forces doctors to do a lot of work with paperwork, dealing with the system, dealing with insurers, all of the things that take you away from the face-to-face with patients. And how are we going to do that? Do we have too many strictures to allow for mindfulness to become commonplace?
We have too many strictures. That's very clear. But the question is, and I think it's really important to make changes in the regulatory climate and the way that the documentation requirements, the things that take physicians away from face-to-face contact with patients, that's essential. But what do we do in the interim? And I've been in many countries and experienced healthcare in many places, and I've yet to find a place that's perfect. I mean, they're all fighting some of the same issues. And so the question is, what do we do in the circumstance that we have? How do you make the time that you have count the most? I also do a lot of research on communication between doctors and patients, and I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of audio recordings of doctor-patient visits. And I'll tell you, some doctors, even with very short amounts of time, use the time exquisitely well, and some people have much more time and seem to never really quite get to the point. So part of it is learning to be a good communicator, but part of it is learning to attend to the right things. Even simple things like sitting down patients will feel that you're more present, and you'll feel yourself more present than if you're standing. I mean, hospital rounds, very often people stand. I bring a chair into the room. I spend the same amount of time as a colleague, but I do spend some time. I make a point of spending the first 2 minutes of any patient visit in the hospital, in my office, face to face with the patient and not looking at a screen. Now, you'd think that that would slow me down, but in fact, it speeds me up because I don't have to ask the same question twice. When I hear the answer, it kind of sticks with me. And when I'm able to do that and really be present, it makes me more effective and more efficient at the same time. And I think that's teachable.
Right. Let me, as we continue on this name, because I know we got a lot on this, we have a call on exactly this subject. So David in Pittsford will help us as well with this. Go ahead, David.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
So my question, I'd like the doctor's feedback on this, is that most doctor's office, unless you're a single doctor with your own practice, if you're in a practice that's run by the U of R or really anybody else, the doctors really must see 20, 25 patients a day. That's what they're being managed to see, which makes it difficult for them to spend a lot of time with their patients. I'm wondering what his comments are. And the reality is that the doctors are being managed to that metric. So where do we go from here?
David, thank you. One of the things I'm hearing from Dr. Epstein is it's more time would be great, but it's spending time more wisely and with more attentiveness to begin with the time you have. Is 20 to 25 an accurate number on patients a day?
I think, you know, some people see more depending on specialty. Some people see less. It just really depends. But I think for a family doctor, that's probably pretty close to it, sometimes more. And I think it really involves just those micro decisions that you make moment to moment about how do you use your time most effectively. You know, sometimes you feel that nothing would be enough, and there are always constraints. But I would say when I'm practicing at my best, patients don't feel rushed, even though the time might be short. When I'm practicing at my worst, then we all feel harried and hurried. So I think it's possible to cultivate a quality of attention that leaves people feeling heard, which is often the main reason people come to the doctor in the first place.
To feel heard.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, if you ask people, you know, what their expectations are for a doctor visit, at least in primary care, many people are expecting a cure for whatever problem they have. But a lot of people come in just to have their problem legitimated, just to say this is a real problem and have someone else acknowledge it.
Here's a question that is sort of a natural cousin to this idea of do we have not enough time to begin with? Is the system not providing for enough quality time? Which is, given those time constraints, is it natural for doctors to do what you are a little critical of in the book, which is kind of rely on a checklist? Say, okay, for this condition, we often see this, 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 and I don't need to see anymore. That's what you've got. You know, let's get you, you know, a prescription, or let's get you on your way to recovery, assuming this is what it is, instead of saying, okay, I've got to be self-aware here. I've got to be open to, I think what I'm seeing may line up with X, Y, and Z, but is there something that might be out of that category? Could I be missing anything else? You know, is it fair to say you're critical of the approach that sometimes leads us to train new doctors to say, okay, you got to move quickly. When your patient shows X, Y, and Z, this is what's going to be, you know, get them moving, get the next one in.
Right. So checklists are really useful. And they can be really helpful. They can keep you from forgetting important things. I mean, they use them in the operating room all the time now. The problem is that good medical care is more than a checklist. And so you need to know when to set that aside and to have a very low threshold for switching between this kind of autopilot state of mind, which you really do need, to a more a kind of slower, more deliberative thinking. And I think the best clinicians accomplish those changes with greater ease. They kind of switch back and forth much more easily. So I'll be going along. I mean, it's like driving a car. You know, if you're driving along a familiar road, there are no obstacles. You know, you do fine. You don't have to pay that close attention. You can have a conversation with someone. You can listen to the radio. But as soon as something's different or surprising, or if it's a rough road that has potholes, you have to pay much closer attention. Now, a good driver will slow down before they hit the pothole. Okay, they'll see it coming. They'll be alert to the possibility that there might be a pothole. So let's say I see, you know, an 18-year-old with a sore throat. I mean, there aren't a lot of things that that could be. You know, it could be a strep throat, it could be a virus, it could be mono. And I very quickly asked the questions that might be able to distinguish those and think about what blood tests or throat culture I might do. But I also think about the one kid that I did see who had leukemia. And so when I'm feeling for lymph nodes in the neck, I'm not just doing it on autopilot. I'm also sensitive to, well, maybe if they're a little larger or harder than they otherwise should be, maybe something else is going on. So I think that threshold for slowing down is much, much, it's much finer tuned in better clinicians.
I think you tell the story in the book of a person with shoulder pain.
Yeah. I mean, this was a patient of mine who was an avid tennis player and had a rotator cuff injury, right shoulder, came in to the office at a time when I was out of town. But this actually could be an error I could have made. I mean, any one of us could do this. But I was alerted to this because when I came back, he had been hospitalized. And this was an otherwise healthy guy. Came in with shoulder pain, and he said he felt kind of things that are kind of swollen around there. And also felt kind of tired. And the first chart note said a recurrent rotator cuff injury and suggested exercises. And didn't get better, came back. The second doctor made note of the fever and chills that he was talking about and said, oh, he probably has a flu plus his rotator cuff injury. And the third time he came back, he said he was really more tired than he'd ever been in his life. And so this was a nurse practitioner, did a blood test, and the blood count was very, very low. He had, and only then when she sent him to the emergency room, did the doctors actually see this 6-inch kind of grapefruit size mass in his armpit just below his shoulder. And I suspect everyone before that had been so focused on the top part of the shoulder, which is the part you usually examine, that they weren't looking at his armpit, you know, 3 or 4 inches away, even though he said he felt a sense of swelling there. And, you know, it's just uncanny when someone has a diagnosis how easily you can just accept that at face value and not question it and just go along as if it were true.
On that subject, this is Paul in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, hi. I have a very low battery, so if I happen to conk out, I will call back. We had an experience with our son, unfortunately, some years ago. He presented with all the classic signs of a stroke in an emergency room. I should say not in the Rochester area. And it turned out he had a vertebral artery dissection. And clinicians just typically don't look for stroke in younger patients. This is not something, unfortunately, that they go to as a maybe a primary diagnosis. And our outcome was horrible in that, you know, he didn't get the prompt treatment that he needed and did not survive the ordeal. So I'm very, very personally mindful of, you know, the word mindful in terms of clinical practice. And you just wonder sometimes as a parent losing a child, how something like this can be missed and how someone can languish in an emergency room when they're testing for everything except what should be patently obvious to them.
First of all, I just want to express my sorrow and condolences of that story. I can't really comment on the care that he received, from my perspective. But this happens in every human enterprise. We make assumptions about situations, and then assume those assumptions are true. It's just that in medicine, those assumptions are often life and death. They can make a huge difference. So this is a human tendency. It's not just doctors. We all do it. It's just the stakes are really, really high. And so what I try to do in order to train doctors to kind of think outside the box, because it's really rare for a young person to have a stroke. I mean, you don't think of that first. Is, for example, if I'm on rounds, I'll ask students and residents the usual kind of questions about, you know, what do you think the diagnostic possibilities are? But I also will ask them a question like, what might you be assuming about this patient that might not be true? Okay? Just in a way to get people to reflect and think a bit outside of the box. This is a question that I can't answer for them.
You were talking earlier about checklists, and I know that there are national stroke protocols with detailed checklists to lead a clinician through kind of a diagnostic thought process. And unfortunately, in our case, there was no evidence that checklist was even used. which made the situation even more unbearable.
I think the tragedy here is that probably someone didn't even think to take the checklist out of their back pocket.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that seems to be the case.
And the situation didn't trigger a response because this is something that, you know, that just didn't occur to them in the first place. And that's often.
So I guess my point would be it's a combination of, you know, of the intuition of a clinician, that sort of presence that you were discussing earlier, but also the importance of protocol. In that there is certain things, or nothing is formulaic in clinical practice, but protocols that are there for a specific reason and need to be used.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. The question is how to help us do better.
Paul, I just want to thank you as well for the call and express also, I'm so sorry for the circumstances there. And we're talking to Dr. Ron Epstein, who is the author of a book called Attending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. And one of the things, Dr. Epstein, that I get from your book is not this idea that a doctor should question every assumption or question, you know, always question to the point of paralysis. It's, you know, lists are okay, rhythms of routine and understanding a likely diagnosis on first glance is okay, but also sort of a self-awareness, a humility that things could change, and an openness to kind of taking in new information, or at least pressing oneself to think, just to make sure that we're not just relying on formula. Is that fair?
I think it's fair, and often we have triggers like that. I mean, a really strong trigger for me is if I wake up in the middle of the night thinking about a patient, that usually is a good indication that I need to go back to their chart and take another look. You know, even if it's just totally unrelated, or if I'm just kind of carrying, or if I feel a sense of unfinishedness after I finish a visit or at the end of the day. Often those kind of hunches or what there's one psychologist calls them fuzzy traces, these just kind of vague senses that things aren't quite right, you can't quite put your finger on it, is an invitation to go back and slow down and take another more careful look. I think this often happens also when dealing with emotional distress in patients. It's not just physical symptoms. Sometimes we kind of miss something, like a patient of mine the other day said he was thinking about taking early retirement, you know, and that kind of went past me for a minute. And then a couple minutes later, I said, you know, I've never heard you talk about retirement before. What's going on? And in fact, he said he was feeling really tired. He wasn't sleeping well. He was feeling depressed. And just that little sentence, that little cue, which was not characteristic for him, cued me into the fact that he was experiencing some mental distress at that time that warranted consideration.
Here's another thing I think it's probably important to point out. If you're listening to Dr. Epstein and you're thinking, well, what he's describing is just sort of being a better listener, a better person, you know, a little less clinical. It's not just that. One of the things that you make the point of in this book is this can be trained, but in a lot of medical training, especially in recent years, and maybe this is evolving, the word suffering doesn't really show up. Compassion is a word that doesn't really show up often. So this can be trained, this approach, yes?
Well, I think, I mean, that's true. I actually looked through mission statements of 40 hospital systems around the country just for these keywords like suffering or compassion or caring. And suffering never occurred. Compassion only occurred actually in Catholic health systems. And the word caring, you know, that has many meanings, but caring in the sense of really taking a personal stake in someone's well-being actually didn't occur all that often. You know, it was often the mission statements had to do with technical quality of care. So part of it is putting that in front of you as something you value. And that's something that leaders in healthcare can do by crafting mission statements and saying, yes, we're going to measure compassion in this institution. We're going to measure well-being. We're going to measure all sorts of things. So I think that's part of it. And I think that medical education has actually gotten quite a bit better in that regard. I mean, people do, with the help of a few foundations that have taken it upon themselves to promote humanism or compassion in healthcare, there's now more talk about this, more, at least in the first 2 years of medical school. So there are literature and medicine courses, and there are, I mean, mindfulness courses actually are pretty common in medical school now. So I think that part has improved. And also in every medical school, there's training and communication skills. I had very, very little. So there is some improvement in the beginning parts of medical school. The problem now that I see is that's not carried through the clinical training into residency, and that trainees see their superiors not acting in ways that are always compassionate.
You tell the story in the book of one of your own experiences when you were in Amsterdam. And later in the book, when you get to the ideas of compassion and suffering, I would find myself linking back to it because, you know, as you say, suffering means different things here. It's not just, you know, a single moment of pain or even a moment of loss. I mean, suffering is different things. And without compassion, you know, we may be missing how patients are impacted. So you were in Amsterdam, and you woke up with a pain in your abdomen. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of my side, actually, more like
it. And what happened?
Well, it was like the worst pain in my life, and I had heard about kidney stones because I had a friend who had had one, I think, and said like it was unimaginably painful. I thought, well, maybe this what's going on, but you know, I really didn't have a clear sense of what was going on. I was in a foreign country and, you know, spoke the language a bit, but not terribly well. And I was taken to the hospital and encountered a health system that was technically quite proficient, but interpersonally completely sterile. And my memories of it were that it was empty, stark white, that people were interested in my symptoms, but not interested in me as a person or what I was experiencing, and no one explained anything to me. And even after I had pain medication, I still felt unsettled and frightened. And this really stuck with me. In fact, the story goes on that after the kidney stone had passed and I went back to the clinic, they started performing all sorts of tests and never really quite explained what they were looking for. And that just continually got me more and more worried until at one point I actually had the presence of mind and saying, you know, why are you doing all these things? And then they explained, well, because I had traveled to Asia before that, they were worried about tuberculosis and various other things. I said, oh, now I understand. And suddenly
you have just told me?
Right. Couldn't you have just told me this? Yes. And my anxiety level went down. But what's happened, not to kind of go on with my own health issues, but I've had a number of kidney stones since. And I'm sure the stones were the same size and had the same difficulty finding their way out. And they were just as painful in one sense, but I kind of knew that there would be an end to the pain and that it could be treated. And the whole experience was a lot less unpleasant just by virtue of having some sense of that this would have a beginning, middle, and end.
A mindfulness approach would have made a big difference,
right,
for you.
Right.
Yeah, and one more, and we'll get to your phone calls coming up, listeners, because we've got a bunch now. One more personal story that I want to ask Dr. Epstein about, because I think it's important too. Everything I have read, and there was a great Radiolab episode on this, about how doctors die differently and how doctors occasionally get sick differently. And by that, I mean, they, you know, by and large, on the averages, doctors do not want the super aggressive treatments that patients often get. You write in the book that the sort of the default is to recommend the most aggressive treatment for just about everything, even if that will lead to more discomfort or, you know, sort of those kind of trade-offs. But doctors don't often do that. And patients will often ask the question, well, what would you do? Mm-hmm. And you even found yourself, even though you're a doctor, you see something on a screen and you end up asking a doctor, what would you do? What's the story here?
Well, actually, there are a couple stories here, but I think you're talking about my own illness.
Yeah, the incidental loma.
Yeah.
The incidental loma.
So one unfortunate side effect of scanning technology becoming so precise. I mean, you can see something that's like an eighth the size of a pea on an MRI scan. I mean, just things that are just totally tiny and on ultrasounds. And so I was having an ultrasound for one of my kidney stones to see if there were any retained stones. And I noticed the ultrasonographer was taking a pretty careful and slow tour of the upper right part of my abdomen. Now, my kidney stone had been on the left side. And I was, you know, I knew enough about this, saying, you know, like, well, what are you doing? And, you know, she's not supposed to say what she's finding, but, well, you know, she said, well, I'm finding something that's interesting. And in medical, these interesting is something that you don't really want.
Interesting is never good.
It's never good,
yeah.
Right?
It's not like, oh, interesting, everything looks great. Yeah,
right, yeah. So a few minutes later, the radiologist came out and said that he found this orange-sized mass in my liver. And he had done some due diligence and gone back to a CAT scan that I had had a few years previously. And sure enough, with a very careful eye, he could see this mass also. And it had grown by about a millimeter in the preceding 8 years. Okay. So, and he was absolutely certain that it had grown. He thought the technology was sufficiently precise. So, I mean, the thought of having this friend, if you will, inhabiting my liver was not particularly comforting. And he said, well, it's probably harmless because there are all these things. And then proceeded to explain to me something that I already knew, which is on these tests, you find in most people, if you look hard enough, little lumps and bumps inside your body, just like you have lumps and bumps on the outside of your body. And most of them are completely innocent, and you weren't looking for them in the first place. And the name that was first coined for this is incidentaloma, something that was incidentally found that you weren't looking for. So, you know, I went to see my primary doctor, and, you know, there was the choice of doing a biopsy, but biopsies carry some risk, you can bleed, or ignoring it altogether, but he said it kind of grew a little bit. You know, I kind of wanted to ignore it and stick my head in the sand initially. Even though I'm a doctor, I kind of had that first reaction.
Very human reaction.
It's a very human reaction.
Yes.
And you know, then suggested, well, maybe get a series of scans after this, and I just found myself, I usually think of myself as a pretty independent decision maker, and I found myself just not wanting to make this decision. And so I asked my doctor, you know, well, what would you do if you were me? Which is a question that doctors dread, because you're never the same person as the patient, and doctors will often answer, well, I'm not you, and there's a whole diverse way that doctors answer that question. It's really fascinating. Some will say, well, go home and think about it, or here, I'll give you a pamphlet and then you can decide. And so here I ask this question that no doctors really like to be asked. Fortunately, my doctor knew me pretty well and said, well, from what I know of you, that sticking your head in the sand is not going to make you feel very good a month from now. You'll probably still be anxious. And one way of trying to resolve this is to do a scan every 4 months for a year and see if we'd notice any growth. And if not, we'll just set this aside. Because if you've had it for 8 years and it's not growing very fast, chances are that it won't harm you.
But he took the time to give you an answer based on his knowledge of you.
That's correct.
The relationship he had with you.
That's right.
And he gave you an honest answer.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the most invasive, the most aggressive.
No, it was not. And I think in that particular case, he would have recommended that to others. But there are many other situations. There's another story in the book where I talk about a colleague of mine I was taking care of on the palliative care service. He was dying of cancer. And he had a cough. And a lung expert was called in, and the lung expert recommended a bronchoscopy, looking down in his lungs and to see if there was a treatable infection. But of course, the bronchoscopy could potentially have serious consequences itself. And so I was called in as a palliative care consultant. I talked with my colleague, and he said, you know, he really just wanted to go home and spend time with his family and didn't really particularly want to be more aggressive about this. And the stunning thing was that I called up the lung specialist who had made that initial recommendation, and he was just totally relieved. He said, you know, that's what I would do if it were me. And what I didn't ask him is, well, then why did you suggest it to one of your colleagues? But I think this is what underlies this is a tendency for us to assume that patients want the most aggressive care possible. And unless someone puts on the brakes and says, no, you know, I really am valuing quality of life, that's likely to come to pass.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about mindfulness, and patients in surveys will say, how do you want to die? I'd like to die at home, if I can, surrounded by people I love. And how do we often die? Hooked up to machines with the most aggressive care possible to the very, very end.
Right.
But it seems with real mindfulness, real compassion, and real questioning, not just the question, and then this is in the book too, what's your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? How do you feel about that question?
Again, you know, it's kind of, if you know the patient and you know how they calibrate it, it's sometimes useful, but I don't find it particularly, I mean, I'd sooner ask a question like, how's the pain affecting your life? Okay. If it's like, I can't think, I can't do anything, I just want to curl up in a ball in bed, that gives me like a picture of what this is like for that person. As opposed to, you know, someone saying, well, it's an 11. You know, and before I had a kidney stone, I didn't know what 10 was, you know, for me, you know, I would have said 10 to a sore throat.
That's right. Perspective changes over
time.
Yeah,
it does. Yes. It does. Yeah. And, you know, labor is another one. I mean, you know, before women experienced labor, it's clearly, you know, the game changes at that point.
The book is called Attending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity by Dr. Ronald Epstein, who is my guest for the hour. You can get the book now. Our friend Holly Anderson, hopefully Holly, I'm not speaking out of school. She sent me an email. I don't think she's going to mind if I mention that. She's with the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester, and she just wanted to say, this is a book filled with hope, kindness, compassion, and deep soul-filled heart. While reading, I found myself wistful for those earlier times when it was possible for patients to develop meaningful relationships with their care providers, a time when patients were listened to and felt heard, a time when physicians were not forced to pay attention to government mandates, shifting payment models, and ongoing battles about maintaining certifications and credentials. But, she says, the book offers hope that maybe we can do that again now, that we can get back to that. And she's just very thankful for that.
Well, thank you. I do have to say something about the good old days. There's actually a part in one of the books by Plato. This is like 2,500 years ago, where he's talking about the doctors of yesteryear as being better than the current doctors they had then at that point. So I think there's this tendency to romanticize the past. I think that, yes, doctors did get to know their patients better, but often were far more paternalistic, and patients were less involved in decision-making. So it was a trade-off. So I think there were good things and some not so good things, you know, talking about 50 years ago.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour and come back to your phone calls. My goodness, this hour is going quickly with Dr. Epstein. We're right back on Connections. And let me tell you about what's coming up Wednesday on the next Connections. First-generation college students face particular challenges when it comes to their university careers. They're also some of the most accomplished students. We're going to hear from local students about their experiences as first-generation students. Then in our second hour, new research on autism that's happening in Rochester. We'll discuss the data and the talk about the new Golisano Autism Center. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I was about to warn our phone callers. We're about to go through some phone calls to try to keep it moving, but I don't want them to feel rushed. I want them to take the time to make the point that you need. We'll get through as many calls as we can, and we're going to start with William in Brighton. Go ahead, William. Hi, William. Are you there? How about this? William, if you can call us back, we'll get you on, I promise. Ralph in Rochester. Go ahead, Ralph.
Hello. Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I just wanted to speak to the doctors and good news or positive comment on doctors that feel something or sense something and then come up with some very important information. I was in a routine physical about 15 years ago, and my doctor was looking at my EKG, and I'd been a marathon runner for years, very fit and healthy. And he says, you know, I want to send you in for an echocardiogram. I just want to verify some, you know, fluctuations on your chart. And I did, and I found that I had a 5-centimeter aneurysm in the aortic upper ascending aorta, which needed surgery, not, you know, emergency, but in very short order afterwards. And, you know, he couldn't explain exactly why he felt that that needed to be done, but it speaks to the point the doctor made.
Ralph, thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Epstein.
Yeah, no, I think it exemplifies just this kind of hunch that you have. And you know, clearly it's an educated intuition. But we don't talk enough about how to educate the intuition when we train doctors. People, it's kind of catch as catch can. And I think we could probably do a little bit better.
Well, Ralph, thank you for that. And Bill in Brighton is now back with us. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you. Dr. Epstein, I know you probably know this, but I had the great privilege 50 years ago to be the door neighbor for 18 years of Dr. George Engels, father of the biopsychosocial model. And for those of you that don't understand that, he created a revolutionary department called the liaison department between psychiatry and medicine. So physician psychiatrists could merge their talents in addressing how medicine ought to be.
Hey, Bill, just let me jump in, only because it's hard for us to hear you. It's just not a good connection. I'm really sorry about that. But Dr. Epstein, can jump in. Go ahead.
I can jump in, actually. George Engel was the reason I came to Rochester.
Yeah.
We were corresponding when I was a third-year medical student and a bit disillusioned with the monochromatic nature of my training, that it really wasn't holistic. And he had written an article that really spoke to me. I wrote to him. He said, come to Rochester. I thought, well, where's Rochester? But that was 33 years ago, and I'm still here. So he made a huge impression. But his ability to connect with people and also understand the connections between mind and body were extraordinary.
Hmm. Bill, thank you for the phone call. Carol in Rochester, next up. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi. I hope I don't embarrass Dr. Epstein, but I am a bit of a cheerleader. About 25 years ago, I was and still am a patient at Family Medicine in Rochester, and Dr. Epstein was my new doctor, and I presented with these little lesions all over my body. And at first, it was thought it was a staph infection, and I was given antibiotics, and they got worse. And Dr. Epstein kept researching, and everything that he tried, it seemed the condition got worse, until eventually I was hospitalized. I had these enormous, disgusting lesions all over my body. And finally, just through his diligence, constant diligence, he discovered this rare disease called Sweet's disease, and it's not a very sweet disease, but it's named after a Dr. Sweet. He initially put me on prednisone just to clear up the lesions that I had, and then determined what my treatment should be ongoing. And when he visited me in the hospital, which he did more than once, he would look, and again, I don't want to embarrass him, but he would look deeply into my eyes. And I remember one day in particular, he said, Carol, you've got this horrible condition going on in your body. I know it's ugly and it's painful, and yet you're smiling. And I said, you figured it out. That's why I'm smiling. You figured it out. He just would not give up. And I just have all the admiration in the world for Dr. Epstein, but I think that's what it takes, a doctor who really cares, who really wants to solve the problem, doesn't just want to throw it away with the initial diagnosis. I don't know what else to say.
Well, Carol, I know he appreciates that, and thank you for the phone call. Go ahead, doctor.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the call. Not all situations end up quite as happily as this, and I think what you bring up is that very often we wrestle with situations that we just don't understand, and we try to figure out what's going on, and it just doesn't fit a pattern. And it's very disturbing to doctors when that happens. I mean, you know, to leave the hospital without a diagnosis gives you this sense of real dissatisfaction. And rather than blaming the patient or blaming yourself or turning away or having some other reaction, just sticking with and remaining curious, I think, is a quality of a good clinician.
Yeah, you have a whole chapter on curiosity and its importance on the patient side, on the doctor side. So but before I jump back to the phones there, you know, can you train someone to be more curious? That's another question.
I think you can provide opportunities and not shut it down. I think that medical students generally are pretty curious about the human condition. And then they're asked very closed-ended questions, fact-oriented questions, that then don't invite them to think more deeply. So I think we can do better.
All right, let me get back to Michael in Rochester on the phones next. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi. I think what I hear you guys talking about instead of mindfulness is what I would coin an old phrase term is bedside manner. And one of the things I see nowadays in the medical world when you go into your doctor's office or you go to a hospital setting is the doctors are so required to electronically keep files of information. So you see them in front of their computers all the time, basically logging all the information in for their patients, which quite frankly distracts them from being able to spend more time with their patients and understand what their patients are going through.
Yeah, I can comment on that. This is really There's a phenomenon that psychologists call interruption recovery failure. It refers to when you're trying to multitask and switching between two tasks. We're not very good at that. Our brains are not very adept at that. And so we spend a lot of time going back and forth and kind of wasting that time, not really paying attention to anything, either the computer or the patient. So I think there are ways to make the computers work better so that they're actually better designed for human brains. And also there are ways to interact with them so you actually at least have some face-to-face time with patients. And that we're just beginning to discover. There was a whole conference I went to in March called The Patient, the Practitioner, and the Computer, at which people were really trying to figure out the optimal way to deal with that human-human-computer interface.
Well, you said earlier this hour, you begin every conversation that you can by sitting down instead of standing, not feeling rushed, and looking face-to-face. If you need to get to a screen, you don't do it right away. You establish that personal contact.
But it took me a while to figure that out, because a lot of people go into the room, log into the computer, then start talking to the patient. And after a year or two of doing that, I realized this wasn't working, and also it wasn't a lot of fun. I didn't go into medicine to be staring at a computer screen. I kind of made a right turn and decided to see what it would be like to spend 2 minutes uninterrupted face-to-face in the beginning of every visit, and it's really worked for me.
That's what I'm going to hope my doctors do in the future, maybe even request it, be a better patient myself, but not in a rude way, but just say, hey, can we sit down? Can we talk face-to-face? And I also wanted to ask you, because I'm panicking, I wanted 2 hours with you. Ron, we don't have enough time. You write about the importance of the difference between sort of top-down thinking versus bottom up. And that kind of, we've kind of touched on some of the outline of that, but can you tell me a little bit more about why that matters in the medical setting and what that means?
Well, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I know a little bit about how attention works. And top-down attention is like you're driving to work and you know there's a stop sign at the end of your street, and almost before you see the stop sign, you're expecting to see it and you start to slow down. Okay, so when you see it, it kind of confirms, it orients you, it gets you, you know, that's how it works in surgery. That's how it works, you know, if you're a car mechanic. It's kind of this bottom up is when things surprise you. So a really good example of a disturbing example of bottom up attention is you're trying to have a conversation. You're standing outside and then an ambulance goes by, you know, roaring its siren, and suddenly you've lost your train of thought. Okay, even though you know the ambulance isn't coming for you or for anything else that's related to you directly, we're just programmed to be interrupted by those. So loud sounds, bared teeth, bright red blood, you know, things that just capture our attention. On the other hand, there are things that should capture our attention that we sometimes miss because they're unexpected, like that blue kidney that I mentioned before. So it's this kind of regulation of bottom-up attention that we need to learn so that it's fine-tuned enough for the things that matter, and we squelch, you know, those things that don't matter that might be irrelevant. And so when you're in an intensive care unit, if you've ever been in one, they're filled with noises and beeps and alarms. They're going off all the time, and people are talking. And how do you focus on what's most important? A good nurse in an ICU has refined that to an art. You know, he or she knows how to tune out the irrelevant stuff and pay attention to the stuff that's more relevant. But do you learn how to do that? I think you can train that to some degree.
You clearly think that mindfulness has come a long way in a couple of decades in this country, yes?
Well, it was a word that people didn't really know much, you know, 20, 25, 30 years ago. Then it kind of got into popular culture. But I would say that now most physicians have some idea of what mindfulness is and have some positive valence for it. I mean, my own story is different than many others. I came to mindfulness a long time before I went to medical school, because I was interested in meditation, and that's something that I do that helps me be mindful. But I think there are many ways of getting there, and you can't prescribe that people do meditation for 8 years before coming to medical school, otherwise you wouldn't have a real lot of doctors. So you kind of have to find your own path and your own way of learning to be more mindful.
Just in our last minute, let me ask you what your colleagues have told you about this book and about these concepts. I know you've heard from people for 2 decades now thanking you for writing on the subject, telling you how much it hit them and they appreciate it. Have you had any pushback?
Surprisingly, none. It's really, I expected something to make somebody angry. I'm actually a little disappointed.
We'll see if we can change that.
Okay.
but really, it has been...
It's been very positive.
That's great.
Yeah, it's been really wonderful.
So are you an optimist now? That what's one thing we can do now? We've talked a lot about your colleagues. What's one thing I can do as a patient to be more mindful of myself as a patient and to help my doctors?
Be attentive to what's most important for you. Put that first. Be an attentive listener, and don't your preconceptions about what your doctor says, set those aside so you can be open to some ideas that might be different than what you expected. And if your doctor tries to make a gesture to be present and really with you, accept that offer.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Epstein, again, we could have probably gone all day with this, and I know our listeners are also patients. Some are patients of yours, as we heard. Many are patients of other doctors. And I know there's a lot of appreciation that that these subjects are coming up, because nobody wants to feel rushed or unheard, as you say. No one wants to feel unheard when they go to the doctor. And I think you're really helping us change that conversation. Thanks for doing it. Thanks for coming in.
I really appreciate being here.
Dr. Ron Epstein is the author of Attending: Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. You do not have to be a doctor. In fact, my guess is many more people who are not doctors than are will pick it up and read it and find something of real value there. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.